Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Jim Goodall. Jim Goodall is a world-renowned expert on the SR-71, a photojournalist and aviation historian. He's worked in aviation museums, worked in restoration projects for aviation, an acknowledged expert with the deep black projects emanating out of Area 51, the Antelope Valley in the high desert of Southern California, and elsewhere. And he was also well known to Ben Rich. We'll have all of Jim's bio information and contact information on our website and our dedicated YouTube channel. So without any further ado, Jim Goodall, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
I'm delighted to be here, James. I can talk airplanes all day long. I can talk spooky airplanes, Area 51. I'm a longtime friend of John Lear and Bob Lazar. I knew Bob before he went out to work in the desert.
Wow. I didn't know that. I'm going to get John Lear on the show. I wanted to get his take because he was instrumental in getting Bob's story out. But, you know, whammo, out of the blue, you tell me that you knew Bob before that whole coming out as Dennis on the Channel 8 program in Las Vegas, which was an epic moment in our UFO field. For the benefit of our listeners, Jim, tell us a bit about your background and how you got into aviation.
Well, I mean, I'm almost 73, so it goes back a long, long ways. When I was five or six, we were living in San Jose, California. It was the early 50s, and it was summertime, or at least it was still out, light out. I had gone to bed already, and my dad came into the bedroom and said, "Jimmy, there's something coming, and you got to see it." So we walked outside. And we were just right across, about 3 miles from San Jose Municipal Airport at the time, and looking towards the Coast Mountains. And all you could hear is, the ground was vibrating, your body was vibrating. And over the Coast Mountains heading to Travis were not one, not two, but 24 Convair B-36s. And with that, my love affair with airplanes was cemented. The next level of in my interest of aviation, when I was starting about seven or eight, my best friend's dad was the base commander at Moffett Field Naval Air Station. And we were always referred to as Captain Smith's son and that friend of his. And my first involvement with a Skunk Works airplane, Danny Smith, my buddy, we had run of the base. All the military police, the Marine Guards, the Shore Patrol, all knew Captain Smith's son and that friend of his. And Danny said, "Hey, there's a neat airplane in Hangar 1. That's the big hangar. It's behind a curtain, but you want to go see it?" And I said, "Sure." So here are two preteens wandering through Hangar 1. Most everybody knew who we were. We went behind this curtain. There was nobody there. And there was the XF-104 Starfighter.
Mm.
And Danny says, "Get in." And now, at the time, it was still top secret. He said, "Get in." So I got in. He closed the canopy, and the canopy latch malfunctioned. We had to call Shore Patrol to get me out of the cockpit. I think my fanny is still hurting, smarting today after all those years. And one thing led to another. My love affair with the Blackbird started on March 10th, 1964. The first YF-12s came in the morning of February 29th, which was a Saturday, 1964. And when they came in from Area 51, they made a no pass or anything, landed and headed right towards the hangar. They had both YF-12s backed up, getting ready to be loaded into the hangar with the engines running. And the heat from four J-58s set off the deluge system in the hangar. It dumped about 60,000 gallons of water almost instantly into the hangar. Of course, the fire alarms went off and everybody with a flight line badge went running.
What base was this at, Jim?
This was at Edwards.
Edwards.
Yeah, I was an 18-year-old kid from, I was stationed at Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. And I went TDY to Edwards to support three programs on ground-based telemetry. It was the YC-141, the XB-70, and at the time, a classified program, which turned out to be the Blackbird. So that's sort of my foundation, you know, from where I started. And once I got out of the service in 66 and really didn't do much as far as airplanes go until about 68. And I sent a letter to Air Force, to Lockheed, to Department of Defense, to CIA, asking for and willing to pay for external photographs of the Blackbird. And the official policy back then was not to cooperate. So because they didn't cooperate, I started digging. The more I dug, the more I found out, the deeper I dug. And that has gone on now for, you know, 60 some odd years, and I'm still digging. So that's sort of my foundation.
I was watching a recent interview of yours. You pointed out how when you got into the Air Force, there was a series of accidents, mishaps that occurred, which may have played a role in determining at some level this destiny. And I'd like to add that when I worked for Naval Communications, I used to have access to the NAV SafeSend mishap reports. And it should be noted to the listeners that military bases, especially aviation-related bases, are extremely hazardous places. There wasn't a week that went by that I'd see in these NAV SafeSend mishap reports, someone was getting run over, someone was falling off of a wing. People were dying constantly. So if you don't mind, if you can relate that part of the story, because I think it's interesting.
We'll be talking about the Blackbirds. You know, they built 50 Blackbirds and they crashed 20 of them. And it was always an interesting way they would try to hide it. When Ken Collins, he was an agency pilot, was flying the third operational A-12 Oxcar Blackbird. It was still running J-75s because the J-58 wasn't online yet. And he was in clouds over the far western end of Utah. And he was descending, but as he was descending, his altitude, his angle of attack, and his airspeed didn't change. And he kept backing off on the throttle. He wasn't sure quite what was happening. And all of a sudden, he found himself in an inverted flat spin. And the only way out of a Blackbird that's in an inverted flat spin is pulling the yellow and black handle in between your legs and wishing for the best. So Ken punched out. He punched out successfully. It turns out that the static pitot tube system on the A-12 had a flaw in it. It had a loop in the line going to the computer that monitors that, you know, the airspeed and angle of attack and whatever. It had gotten water in there and froze. You know, normally the static pitot tube on almost any airplane is ratcheted up to about 1,000 degrees. And most of the static pitot tubes are made by Rosemont. Back then they weren't. And that caused a false reading on his triple display indicator, his altitude and his airspeed and everything. So when it crashed about 20 miles south-southwest of Wendover, Utah. And the way the Air Force was able to cover it up, they put out an announcement that a Air Force F-105 Thunder Chief with a nuclear weapon had crashed in and around Wendover, Utah, and there was plutonium scattered all over the area and for people to stay away. Well, at that particular point in time, there wasn't an F-105 in the United States Air Force that was flying, but it was a way they kept people away from the crash site. And as it turns out, my dear friend Peter Merlin actually spent probably about 10 years trying to locate the exact site and found where Ken's airplane, his A-12, crashed. So that's some of the stuff that the Air Force and the military does in general, especially if you're dealing with a black program. And at the time, there wasn't hardly anything any more classified than Oxcart and the A-12 program. It was, you know, almost everything was secret or top secret or special access required.
What became the SR-71 had, if memory serves, a titanium hull. Could you describe to the listeners what that meant in practice? And I guess they had to deal with the high friction at altitude. It kind of superheated the exterior of this thing, and the pilots had to wear special flight suits. Is that the case?
Well, the airplane, the A-12 and the SR-71, can fly virtually any day of the week at 85,000 feet at Mach 3.2. The only Blackbird that couldn't do that was the Titanium Goose, which was an A-12 trainer that's sitting on a pylon at the Museum of Science and Industry in L.A. That was only powered by Pratt & Whitney J-75s. Now, Bill Park did go Mach 2 in that airplane, but he had to climb to 50,000 feet, put it in almost a straight down nose down dive where he hit Mach 2 and then pulled out. And so he was able to say that, yes, it was that one could fly Mach 2. But the Blackbird's original requirement was sent out to both General Dynamics Convair and Lockheed. They had to choose titanium because of its strength at high temperatures. Kelly had predicted before the airplane, this is Kelly Johnson, had predicted even before the airplane flew, he pointed to various areas on a drawing of the Blackbird and said it would be 520 degrees here and 800 degrees here and 1100 degrees and so on and so forth. Well, he was sort of a walking supercomputer because once the airplanes were flying and they had systems that could measure the temperatures, he was only off by about a half to 1.5 degrees on all the areas he pointed out to. So they had to use titanium because it has a very, very low coefficient of expansion. Two, it's as light as aluminum, but it's as strong as stainless steel. And the ironic thing, out of the 50 Blackbirds that were built, the 25 operational SR-71s were all built using Soviet Union titanium sponge.
We take it for granted. We live in an age of computer simulations, computer diagnostics, CAD, et cetera, et cetera. Back then, a lot of the design engineers for the aerospace community, they did a lot of this stuff, pencil and paper and, you know, that kind of thing. Wasn't that the case?
There was no such thing as a computer back in the late 1950s when they were designing the Blackbird. You used yellow tablets and very big slide rules. My dad had one. It was about 2.5 feet long. He called it his supercomputer. Today's kids, today's adults have no idea. A lot of them don't have an idea what a slide rule is. But it's a remnant of past times. But the real interesting thing, the heart and soul of Mach 3 flight, besides the engine, the Pratt & Whitney J-58, is the inlet. The inlet cone starts at Mach 1.2, it starts transitioning back, and it moves back 26 inches. At speed and altitude, inlet is sucking in somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2 million cubic feet of air per second. And that air has to be slowed down to subsonic before it goes into the face of the engine. So in 20 feet, you're going from 3,400 feet per second to subsonic. And you have, due to compression and friction, that same air that was at minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit has now been elevated to 830 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a 900 degree rise in temperature in 20 feet. So back in the late 70s, NASA, when they were still flying the SR-71, which they call the YF-12C, they decided if they could design an inlet using two controlled data supercomputers, what would they come up with? They knew they had to keep a round inlet, and they knew they were going to use the Pratt & Whitney J-58. So they spent 15 months on a supercomputer, actually two of them. And the end result, they said, if we designed the inlet today, we would probably use some different materials for some of the seals. Other than that, the design was absolutely optimum for what it was designed for. And Ben Rich told me years ago that one of his right-hand men that helped with designing the inlet, he said he could visualize airflow at almost any Mach number. And Ben said that this guy probably didn't finish ninth grade.
Wow.
He just had that sense about him. And there are people like that. Kelly Johnson's one of them. I said in an interview years and years ago, Kelly Johnson was to the aviation world what Thomas Edison, Leonardo da Vinci, and Albert Einstein were to their, you know, specific areas of interest. He has no peers. Kelly Johnson was a one of a kind. The only person that could possibly fill his shoes was Ben Rich. And since then, you know, most everybody else who's headed up the Skunk Works have rested on the laurels of primarily Kelly Johnson and Ben Rich. They're all talented. I know quite a few guys there at the Skunk Works still. It's an interesting place. I can honestly say I've been in the engineering offices at the Skunk Works within the last 12 months, but my buddy, who's been there for 34 years, just retired, so I won't be going there anytime soon.
We're delving into the area and have been delving into the areas of special access programs. Can you tell the listeners how the special access programs came into being, where the military, I guess, would let these contracts to the aerospace firms and Skunk Works Lockheed, for example? They provide a means of specially allocating the money, so it was off the books. And, of course, they would have to create a whole infrastructure for all this. Could you go into a bit about how this deep black world came into existence to the way it is now?
Well, I mean, much like the Manhattan Project, which they actually built the first reactor underneath the stands at football field or basketball field in the city of Chicago. I don't think anybody realized that there was radiation and potential for a major catastrophe if something had gone wrong. Let me put it this way: in the areas that I have dug stuff up on, most of the reasons for classification have nothing to do with national security. Majority of the reasons for classification in a lot of areas is because they don't want the average congressman or the American public know where these billions of dollars are being spent. You know, on the Blackbird's behalf, it was probably the best spent money of any Blackbird program ever.
We've gone to the next generation or generations after the Blackbird. In the 90s, there was a lot of talk of the Aurora and other so-called hypersonic craft. When I had pulled over into Bakersfield, California at a rest stop, I had reclined the chair of the driver's seat as far back as it could go, and I'm laying there. And this is broad daylight, early afternoon. Suddenly the ground starts shaking. In my rational mind, I'm thinking, okay, there's like a big rig pulling into this rest stop area. And then I just barely see, just below the driver's side window, an arrowhead-shaped craft, desert tan colored beneath. It was being trailed by a distinct smoke ring behind it. And it just flew from where I spotted it, and it flew out of sight in just a matter in like split seconds. And I said to myself, I guess that's the Aurora everyone's talking about. The ground is shaking. I'm looking at it, and it's got a smoke ring behind it. What did your sources tell you about these next generation so-called hypersonic craft, and generally about how many are there?
I have a dear friend who has since passed away. You know, we were roommates in Denver starting in 1962. He was an air traffic controller. He was one of only nine air traffic controllers that did not go on strike during the Reagan administration. And he was a senior controller at the Bay Area TRACON in Oakland, California. He wasn't aware of my absolute passion for spooky airplanes. And I was over at Bob's house. His name was Bob Garrow. He's since passed away, so I can use his name. We were talking one evening, and he said, you know, and this is like March of 81, 82 timeframe. He said they tracked an air-breathing manned aircraft traveling through their airspace. Now, the Bay Area TRACON goes out to about 250 miles in all directions from Oakland. You know, this aircraft was approaching 60,000 feet, and estimated speed was somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
And it had priority over everything, including the SR-71, because they were still operational at Beale. Now, the only airplane that that had priority over the SR-71 up till that time was Air Force One, that has priority over everything that's in the air. So they called Beale because they had the tape. They calculated that it was going magnetic 310. So if the start point's Area 51, the flight path would take it directly off the coast of Oregon near Coos Bay. So they called Beale, a full bird colonel, and a young captain came to the TRACON. Now the colonel went and talked to the director of the center, and the captain started talking to my friend Bob Garrow. Now Bob prided himself in being the best air traffic controller on the planet. And this captain came up and looked at Bob and said, "Well, Mr. Garrow, you probably didn't know what you're looking at." And Bob just went nuts. How dare this guy, insult me this way? And he looked at the captain and he said, "Buddy boy, I've been managing high-speed aircraft, including space shuttles, since before your father porked your mother for the first time." he was getting really, he was getting under the collar. And the colonel heard the commotion and came back out into the TRACON and said, went up to Bob and said, "Mr. Garrow, you don't understand. You didn't see a thing." And this is what Bob told me even before he had any idea that I love spooky airplanes. So is Aurora real? Everybody I've talked to, including Ben Rich, who replaced Kelly at the Skunk Works, none of them have said my theory is full of holes. The only thing in a conversation I had with Ben Rich, we were talking about the Tester Model Company and their XR-7 Penetrator and their SR-75, I guess they had it. It was a model. It was a 72nd scale or quarter inch scale. He said, "I'm really disappointed in Tester's Aurora." I said, "Why is that, Ben?" He said, first of all, the fuselage is too small. A liquid methane fueled aircraft would have to have an internal volume at least 4 to 5 times the size of the Tester model. And he said, "This Mach 12 aircraft would probably run out of fuel from the time it left the test site. It'd probably run out of gas over Pasadena if it had a fuselage that small." So here Ben told me Mach 12 liquid methane fueled aircraft that sort of validated what Bob had seen. So I tried to push him some more, but he didn't want to go there. So I backed off. But years later, just before Ben died, I was talking to him at USC Medical Center. And we were talking again about John Andrews and the design of his Aurora. He said, "Jim," says, "we have things out in the desert that's 50 years beyond what you can comprehend. Not what you think you can build in 50 years, but what you can comprehend." He said, if you've seen movies like Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort. And that, coupled with the letter that he wrote to John Andrews in June of 86, where he said, where John Andrews had asked Ben Rich in a letter, I have a copy of both letters, and Michael Schratt has the originals, asked him, he said, "Do you believe in UFOs?" Now, we have two categories, both man-made and extraterrestrial. And Ben came back on his corporate letterhead as president of the Lockheed Skunk Works. They said, "Both Kelly and I are firm believers in both categories. We refer to ours as unfunded opportunities," and underlines the F and the O. Said, "But beware, there are people out there that will lead you astray and some that may do you harm." So when I was talking to Ben, I say, this is just before he passed away, talked about, if you've seen movies like Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there and done that. I said, "Ben, you want to expand upon that?" And he just politely said, "No." And that was the last conversation I had with Ben, and he passed away about 10 days later.
Now we're delving into the areas of field propulsion, electrogravitics, electromagnetism, artificial gravity. correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, the principles behind such means of lift, propulsion, et cetera, were well understood in the aerospace field. In fact, Bill Hamilton used to talk about how there was an article that came out in Popular Mechanics magazine saying in the 1950s, saying that the craft of the future won't rely upon, you know, wings and won't rely upon jet engines, et cetera. It's going to be of a next far superior design than as previously understood. Do you see a demarcation point where in the deep black world, we began having these saucer crashes, crash retrievals of alien technology? The late, great Leonard Stringfield talked about this in his research. And then that technology being gotten a hold of by the military and then the aerospace community, and then the back engineering efforts began. And what did your sources tell you in that regard?
Well, I have I wouldn't say a dear friend, but a longtime friend who was a senior guy at Pratt & Whitney. And we were talking about what evolves after the Blackbird, because the Blackbirds, at the time I asked him the question, were still flying. And he said, in today's aerospace world, they have, you know, they've pretty much extracted out all the potential energy and capabilities of a kerosene-based propulsion system. We're talking about jet engines versus not talking about rockets. He said, the next major advance in propulsion will be electric. Now, this is about 30 years ago when the guy made that comment, and we're starting to see that today. There's stuff out in the desert that, again, Ben said, they have things that are 50 years beyond what you can comprehend. That's a pretty amazing statement all by itself.
Well, I've been at Rachel, Nevada, and I was standing outside one of those double-wide trailers that you're probably familiar with.
Oh, yes.
I was staying inside of them. You know, I was visiting. And it was about 3:30 in the morning. And it was on a Saturday night. A lot of people talk about, well, a lot of the real stuff doesn't happen till middle of the week, Wednesday, whatever the case may be. But I'm standing, you know, waiting for some friends who never showed up. Ironically, we're going to go on a Skywatch. And out of the test site, this is not even the Papoose Lake part of the facility. It was like right over the Groom Mountains there, right over the test site, flying off to the northwest, were six silent elliptical luminous craft that flew right overhead, two of which zigzagged between each other and flew off to the northwest without a sound. And it's like I was blinking my eyes. Like, did I really just see that? You know what I mean? So there's definitely something going on there. And we've seen enough video over the years, Jim, to strongly suggest that there is the test flying or something of a very advanced nature at the Groom Lake and Papoose Lake facilities.
I've interviewed about 15, 16 different people who have worked at Area 51. And if Honeywell, Rosemont, Pratt & Whitney, Lockheed, Air Force, you name it. All the real, and I've been told by multiple people, all the real spooky stuff at Area 51 only comes out on weekends, preferably long weekends. They usually, if it's going to be a daytime launch, they usually launch somewhere within an hour of sunrise and back on the ground at within about an hour and a half after flying. So the real spooky stuff flies on weekends. They have a system at Area 51. If something's going to fly during the week, they make an announcement on the public address system that if only people with a yellow or a green or a purple security badge can be outside, everybody else has to go inside. Stop what you're doing and go inside. Because there's stuff that flies that even people that are cleared to be at Area 51 aren't allowed to see. So it's finally, you know, hearing something at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday would go right along with the fact that all the real spooky stuff flies on weekends.
Well, thanks for that confirmation, because I was there precisely for a long weekend. I was there for the UFO friendship campouts that Joe and Pat Travis used to host. And I can't remember if it was Labor Day weekend, it was 4th of July weekend, whatever it was, but that's what I was there for. It was a long weekend. It was Saturday night verging on Sunday morning. So that's interesting that you should point that out. Please continue.
I've known Joe and Pat since I first went to Rachel in 87. And Stu Brown from Popular Science, and we called it the Dreamland Interceptors. We put Rachel, Nevada on the map. If you recall, there was an article in Popular Science, March of 94, that had a nighttime shot of Area 51. Well, that was taken by Stu Brown when Stu and myself and Glenn Campbell were on the top of Whitesides Mountain overlooking Area 51. And circulation was about 6 million people. It's because of that, primarily, that piece of Popular Science that put Rachel and the little alien on the map. And then we had the character Glenn Campbell, not the singer, but the guy who ran the Area 51 Research Center.
The Desert Rat newsletter he came out with.
Yeah. So he also had a Area 51 viewer's guide that he had self-published. That was interesting. It started at about 30 pages, and I think the final iteration was probably about 80 pages on where to go, where to hike, how long it takes, what you should have with you, what you can expect to see, and so on and so forth.
Now, I know that Joe Travis passed away. Is Pat Travis still with us?
I drove my Harley through Rachel May of 2014 and stopped at the little alien. And Pat was in Vegas getting some supplies. So she's still around.
Oh, good, good. Wonderful couple. I consider them true American heroes for what they did and all the harassment and interference and the slagging from mainstream media they received. So out of the goodness of their hearts, they put on these UFO friendship campouts periodically. And now you mentioned at the outset that you knew Bob Lazar before he went public. What's interesting was I met Bob Lazar there at the little alien. He just plopped up next to me in the chair, and pretty soon he got into an impromptu discussion. Did you want to tell the audience how you first got to know Bob Lazar before he became well-known?
Well, John Lehrer and I, this is early 89. Yeah, somewhere like that. They had already acknowledged the existence of the F-117, but there was only one photograph of it, and it was backlit. It was overcooked negative, shot with a telephoto, which compressed the size of the airplane. And John Lehrer and I had a Cadillac Seville that I rented, and we're hitting up US 95. We're near Scotty's Junction, and an F-117 went flying right over our head. I mean, we both almost had an orgasm as the thing went flying by. So we had, we headed out to the fence line. John knew where to go. We headed to the fence line there at Tonopah Test Range. And I got a shot of the first civilian to photograph the F-117, but it was on print film. And we had gotten back to Vegas, and all the photo mats were already closed. It was after 9 o'clock. And John said, well, I got a buddy of mine coming over who has a C-41 film processor unit at his house. He does that for real estate agents. Said, oh, okay. So we were at his house about 10 minutes, knocking the door, open door, and it's Bob Lazar. We just sort of casually talk and ask him how he met John, and they met through some real estate people, and one thing led to another. And he said he was a weapons designer at Sandia Lab for a while, but he was asked to come and interview for a job out in the desert. He didn't say where at the time. So I said, well, let's, can we get this film process? I want to see what I have. And he said, sure. So he had at the time it was a Datsun. It was a 240 or 260Z. And we left John's house, which is over near Nellis, and we went across town to Bob's house off of, I can't remember the name of the road right now, but went to his house, we're processing the film, and Bob looks at me and he says, you know, I feel really bad for John Lear. I said, why do you feel bad for John? He said, we've come from such a famous aviation family, and the guy believes in UFOs. I mean, he's looking at me with this dumbfounded, how could you believe in UFOs? He said, if I can't prove it mathematically or put my hands on it, it doesn't exist. Okay, fast forward about a year, and there's a backlit silhouette of a guy talking, voice has been changed, saying he worked at a place called S4 at the southwest corner of the Papoose Range, which backs up to Area 51. Turns out that was Bob. And for a guy who said you couldn't put a gun to his head to convince him the UFO was real, for him to come out because he feared for his life, that he was a firm believer. He actually put his hands on, which he called the sports model. And he was, you know, and the thing about Bob, even if it was to his, you know, to benefit his pocketbook, he never, ever exaggerated what he said on his interviews with George Knapp. His story has always stayed the same. And the other thing to add to Bob Lazar's credibility, there's a lot of people out there who say, well, he's full of baloney. You know, he's a charlatan. He doesn't, you know, he never worked there. To that comment, I said, baloney. If you're working in a classified environment and Bob gave phone numbers and room numbers and everything, he worked at Sandia Lab. People have gone to Edward Teller when he was still alive and asked him about Bob Lazar, and Teller just said no comment. Everybody that during George Knapp's investigative work on Lazar, everybody that he asked, will you comment on Bob Lazar, they all said no comment. Now, if he was a fake, if he was a charlatan, they would have said so. Said, that guy is full of baloney. I've never seen him, never heard of him until recently. He's a fake. But no, all they ever said was no comment, because you cannot comment one way or the other. You can neither confirm nor deny the existence of a classified program operation or a person that worked in a classified environment. So that right there validated, as far as I'm concerned, that Bob Lazar is who he said he is. And the other thing, one of the things that George Knapp did, he went to Albuquerque. He got on base there at Kirkland. He went to the library, the public part of the library at Sandia, found a phone book on the time that Bob said he worked there. He opens up the phone book, and there's Robert Lazar, the phone number that he had given George, the room number he had given George, checked out. The persons he said worked in the same office, he looked them up, the same people. Now, let's fast forward to 1991. It's Desert Shield. This is before Desert Storm. I'm activated. I was in the Minnesota Air Guard as a historian. And I was activated, go to the Pentagon, and my job was to pull everything associated with Army or Air Guard operations during Desert Shield and Desert Storm. So I saw everything that pretty much the chairman of the Joint Chiefs would see. But one day I had a little bit of time, and I had in my back pocket a copy of Bob Lazar's W-2 from when he worked for the Navy.
Yes, the Naval Intelligence W-2 form.
Yes. Yes. So I'm working out of the Pentagon. I looked up where Naval Intelligence is, and I'm in uniform. At the time, I was a tech sergeant. And I go into the office of the director of Naval Intelligence, and there was a Navy lieutenant commander behind the desk. And I said, sir, I showed him Bob's W-2. It turns out in Washington, D.C., the zip code is 202, starts 01, and goes up to 43. From about zip code 202, 35 to about 41 or whatever, they go to classified locations. So I showed this, you know, this Bob's, I had marked out his social security number. And he said, "What, Sergeant, wait right here." And he goes into the Admiral's office, a two-star rear admiral. Said, "The Admiral would like to see you." So I go in there and I do a sharp salute. And this two-star looks up at me and he said, "Sergeant, I don't know where in the hell you got this W-2 from. But if I ever see you cross the threshold of my office again, you'll be the sorriest son of a bitch and tech sergeant in the United States Air Force. Now you're dismissed." I did an about face and out I went. I mean, I really just, this really set this guy off. So that's another add to the credibility of Bob Lazar. If it was a joke of a W-2, if it wasn't what it said it wasn't for a lot of money. But the fact is that when you have a two-star admiral get pissed at you because you have a W-2 from a guy who doesn't really exist, and Bob doesn't exist prior to 1989. They've gotten rid of, he doesn't exist, period. And there's people out there, and they're friends of mine, too, who don't believe Bob is who he says he is. And I will stand behind Bob 100% of the time.
Some key points to make before the end of this first fascinating segment. Thanks so much, Jim. It's standard operational procedure to expunge the official record of certain individuals in the military and in the black ops world. A lot of the atomic veterans who were there ordered to march at ground zero after an atmosphere, above ground nuclear test, and they got sick, came down with leukemia, etc. Either their military records show them to be elsewhere during that time, hence no claim for compensation, or that whole part of their records have just disappeared. Also, you have the situation in St. Louis, the military's record archives there just burning down to the ground. I think of the American prisoners of war that were captured and taken to Japan, put to work as slaves by the Japanese corporations. Their story has went into a black hole. And so you have example after example of active duty military personnel whose records have just been absolutely altered or expunged, first point. Secondly, I attended a workshop of George Knapp's years ago, and he talked a lot of inner details about the Bob Lazar story he didn't have time to share in his regular lecture. He said, George Knapp said, that he developed the source who worked at S4, and he told this source about Bob Lazar. The person was skeptical about Bob Lazar. And then he arranged a meeting between the source who worked at S4 and Bob Lazar. And the source asked Bob Lazar a number of pointed questions. What's the layout of the place? Where is the cafeteria? How do you pay for the food? Et cetera, et cetera. And then the guy came out of that meeting with Bob Lazar and said, "This guy has been to all those places he says he's been. He's really been there." And also, Bill Hamilton's sources in the Antelope Valley, and he developed in Nevada, said the same thing. Bob Lazar is a real guy. He's really been to these places. And one final point, and I'd like your thoughts before we end this part of the segment. In that brief time I sat with Bob Lazar and chit-chatted with him amongst several other people, he did come across still, after all that time, as being very skeptical about a lot of stuff. It's like if he doesn't have something tangible in his hand, it's like everything else that's related to the UFO field or tangential to it, it's like he doesn't want to know about it. It's got to be something that he can literally sink his teeth into. So he had that mindset, Jim, of being a very, almost dogmatic scientist that had to see it to believe it.
Yeah, and the thing about it, it could have been tens of thousands of dollars in his pocket if he would have just expanded a little bit, glorified or just, BS, some stuff that never really happened. It would have been very, very financially beneficial to Bob. Now, one quick thing before we go to break. I got a buddy of mine. He's still dealing with black programs out of Wright-Patterson. But he was on the F-117 program. So it's going back to 1980 through about 83. He was at Area 51. And they had their badge allowed them really to go anywhere in the Nevada test site. They were clear, you know, they had clearance for everything. So one day there, you know, about three or four guys are in a Humvee. They had a Humvee to use. They drove around the north side of the Papoose Range and followed a dirt road to this dry lake bed on the southwest corner of the Papoose Range. And he said it was a fairly well-used road, but it sort of stopped at the lake bed. And my friend said, out of nowhere appeared five or six guys in black fatigues or BDUs, armed to the teeth, asking them who in the hell they were and what are you doing here? They don't know. They didn't see a vehicle. There wasn't any place that they could have been, but they arrived. I mean, they were there. And my friend said, well, we're over on the other side of the mountain on a program. And we had some free time. We thought we'd explore. He said, well, you've done your exploring. Now leave. So they left. This is the place that Bob said S4 is located. Another guy a gentleman who is a Mormon historian, was researching the trail of the lost Mormon tribe and went right through Area 51 through Mercury, and they were lost somewhere in the desert. And he had asked permission from Air Force and from DOD if he could get into the area near Mercury, and they said no. So he decided, you know, the heck with rules and regulations. He hiked in, and he found an undercropping where he spent the night. And he's trying to find proof of the lost tribe. He said at night, it was late at night, something woke him up, and he's looking towards the south end of the Papoose Range, where S4 is allegedly located. And all of a sudden, he sees like a garage door opening. Now, he's about 15, 20 miles away, but it's crystal clear. What doors open up. You see some activity, doesn't see anything fly, and then the doors close. I don't know how long the interval was from time they opened until they closed. It was there for a while. The next morning, he gets out his binoculars and takes a look, and there's nothing there. There's just a mountain that at the base of the mountain is a dry lake bed. That was it. What had caused the lights? You know, he can only speculate. And he's not a UFO person. He is not an airplane person. He's a religious historian.
Sounds like some pneumatically powered doors or something. And we've heard similar stories at the Northrop underground facility, the Anthill in the Hatchimi Mountains, where these big doors would just suddenly flip open, or like a big hatch would slide open and light would pour out from the interior of this mountain or the interior of this underground facility. Quick point to make for our listeners in the UK and Australia and elsewhere, a W-2 form is what the tax department in America, the Internal Revenue Service, it sends to the taxpayer, the employee, and it's also has to do with the earnings someone has accrued, gross pay and net pay from their employer. And so on the W-2 tax form, official tax form sent by the IRS, the Department of Naval Intelligence was listed. This is the form that Jim had followed up on with Director of Naval Intelligence Office. And then Jim, of course, in the hair-splitting department, people had a conniption fit. Oh, well, you know, it's called Department of Naval Intelligence. That's false. No, they used to be N2 was the organizational name in general for Naval Intelligence. Before this whole Director of National Intelligence thing came aboard, there was only the Director of Naval Intelligence in the field of the intelligence community. And within Naval Intelligence, there was a special branch called Office of Naval Intelligence that dealt specifically with technical issues, that kind of thing. And so, you know, again, in the hair-splitting department, they try to make an issue out of something, but it's not an issue. They're just blowing smoke. Well, we reached the end of a fascinating first segment. In the second segment, Jim will talk about some of the stories and information he heard from sources within the aerospace military aviation field relative to what goes on at Area 51 as far as the back engineering of alien technology and that kind of thing. Could you tell us, Jim, how the listeners can contact you if they have any special information? And also, please mention the books that you've got. You've written books on the subject and your website, et cetera.
So I don't have a website. I should, but I don't. I'm just working on my 26th book right now, and I specialize in low observables. I have my fifth and probably my best, the best book ever put together on the blackbirds will be coming out in May from Schaeffer Publishing out of Pennsylvania. It's 224 pages, 710 photos, of which about 35 to 40% of them have never been in print. They've been on, they've been on the internet, but not in print. And of those, about 15% or so have never seen the light of day before. So it is the go-to piece for anybody who is in love with the blackbird. I like all things stealth. So my newest book from Schaeffer came out this summer, was on the Los Angeles class 688 fast attack submarines. And prior to that, I did a photo essay on the B-2. I mean, they even let me fly the simulator for a couple hours.
Wow.
And photographed in the cockpit on top of the airplane. They won't let you do that anymore. I don't know why, but it's like closing the door after the barn door after the cows got out. My last three books are all from Schaeffer Publishing. They're hardbound. They're landscape format. And everybody, and I couldn't be more excited about the books. Everybody that has seen them, like a friend of mine, Jim Stevenson, he's a world famous author. He did the book on the A-12 Avenger II, the General Dynamics Mach Air debacle, the flying Dorito chip. He read it and his comment was, well, if you have the B-2 book or the 688 book or the Blackbird book, you don't need anything else. You have everything you could ever want in a book on that particular piece of hardware. That's where I'm at today. I'm working on my Seawolf Virginia class book, and then I'm going to be working on the Ohio class SSBN, SSGN, Arsenal boat and ballistic missile boat. And I think probably my 28th and last book will either be on Half Blue, or if I live that long, I'll do an extensive one on the D-21 program, Tag Board and Senior Bowl. I've already done one on that was published years ago in, was it International Aviation News or something like that. It was a book printed out of the UK, or came out of the UK. It was part of Airtime. And in Volume 3, I had a 1,200-word piece on the D-21 program. That's the most that's ever been written on it. That's where I'm at. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm on Facebook. I don't know if I want to send out my email.
You don't want to be inundated with all this stuff.
I still get about 400 emails a day, of which 99% of them are garbage.
Yeah, I'm glad mine slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
And if memory serves, correct me if I'm wrong, the Virginia class, is that a fast attack boat, Hunter Killer? And then the Ohio is a submarine launched ballistic missile sub?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And is it, I've heard rumors that it's in the works or in the planning stages for a successor to the Ohio. They're going to come up with something after that.
It's the Columbia class.
Yes.
It'll probably be based on the Virginia class, and it will not have 24 launch tubes. It will only have 16.
Okay.
And as it is today, the 12 Ohio class ballistic missile subs have four of their 20 launch tubes have just been filled with ballast. They're inoperable. And that was part of SALT II, the reduction of launch platforms for the U.S. versus with the Russians have.
Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first half, and we've got so much more to go. To our dear listeners, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.